Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, June 24th, 1998. In the Creekside room this evening is Frank Rogers. Today's session number is 98-6, and it's titled, The Practice of Discernment. Let's listen in.
Jack Schramm suggested that I announce that this is a lecture on Lutheran theology. Cut the room in half. I have to attribute that to Jack since I'm Catholic.
Even better, huh?
Yeah. That's right. You want a real take on Lutheran theology. That's right. The abandoned brother here. We got one chair right there. So, and a couple of pillows here. And we are ready to begin. The tape can roll. I am Frank Rogers, and this is a session that's going to look at the practice of spiritual discernment. This is not the second session in the Spirituality and Story series. That will be tomorrow. This is kind of an interlude looking at this practice. It's in the book, Practicing Our Faith. But it's not irrelevant to that other series at all. I'm looking at trying to see where God's movements are in the world and how we might participate with those. I am assuming that, well, it's great to have so many of you all here, and I'm assuming that some of you have read this chapter from the book Practicing Our Faith and may already have questions and want to engage in dialogue around that, but I also by no means assume everybody's read it, so I imagine a lot of you all have not looked at this particular chapter, or so I think I might do a little bit of introduction to the chapter and the material in it as a context, or some of it, as a context for our discussion. I'm particularly delighted that many of the cast of Soul Purpose are here, especially in light of the piece that they just did, and perhaps we can also talk about some of the ways in which that play intersects with themes from this chapter and this practice on discernment. I think I'm going to go ahead and start as I was planning. I want to start out with a little anecdote, a vignette, kind of a story. That's the story that didn't make it into the chapter. It was the opening story, and at the last final version, we decided it's just not the right one for the opening, but I love this story so much I want to tell it anyway. And it's related to the practice in some ways, and also to my own story with this practice. The context for it is about 6 years ago, 5 years ago, my wife and I, my ex-wife, separated. And in the midst of that separation and eventual divorce, it took 2 or 3 years to come to that decision. I went into a nosedive. I mean, I just kind of caught myself in that vertigo of depression, and I took a leave of absence from my work, and that was the one meeting I missed from this practices group. It was also the one that all the different individual practices were assigned. And I was assigned the practice of discernment in my absence. Now, that may have been divinely providential, or it may be cosmically serendipitous, or just a coincidence, depending on your theology. But that's what happened, and I was then asked upon my return to engage in this practice. And it was, to say the least, intimately woven with my own journey as I agonized, and my ex-wife agonized, and all of the complexities of a gut-wrenching decision. During that period of time, Justin was about 4 years old, I guess, and we were staying in a one-bedroom apartment, and we were finishing up a meal, dinner, and Justin's mom, Kim, was coming to pick him up in about a half an hour. And we were going through that mourning process of having to say goodbye, and the reunions and the goodbyes all wrapped up together. And so I looked at Justin as he was eating his can of SpaghettiOs or whatever, and I said, Justin, now your mom's going to be here in about a half an hour. And then you'll be there for several days, and then you'll come back on Thursday. Is that all right with you? And he said, you know, Dad, that's not all right. And I said, oh, okay, well, what would you like? And he said, well, I want God to unmake the divorce. said, well, okay. Well, Justin, how would God unmake the divorce? And he said, well, we could give it to God. And then God and Jesus could get divorced. And when God and Jesus get divorced, God is going to be really sad. And when God gets sad, God is going to cry. And sometimes when we cry, things get better. Well, we sat there in the silence, contemplating the rupture in the very Trinitarian community of God and the pain of that. And after a few moments of silence, Justin finally offered, but you know, I bet God gets really tired of crying after a while. Is there any way we can help God stop crying? Well, that story didn't make the cut, but it's true nonetheless. And I want to volunteer that story for several reasons. One of them is that when we look at the practice of discernment, and in only its more purely focused form, does that mean making decisions? We need to look at that in a theological context. What we are doing is we are trying to navigate the twists and the turns of our lives, making decisions, responding to events, within the context of knowing that we are in a world in which God's presence is intimately woven into it. And our hope is that we will be able to make decisions and respond to life in ways that participate with God in the healing of the world. What kind of decision can we make that does help God stop crying? What kind of decision can we make that nurtures some healing? What kind of a decision can we make that nurtures reconciliation and justice and power and individuality and giftedness and all of the ways in which those collide and conflict in the ways that are most mutually enhancing? How do we do that? It's within the context of God's participation in our world that we practice not just making decisions, but the practice of discernment. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But a couple of other things about that story that I want to allude to, and that is, there are moments in life, we've all experienced them, when the truth has been told. And when that's been told, we feel it down deep. And that truth might be being in touch with a deep, deep pain in the world and the pathos that comes with. Or it might be a truth of joy and liberation, feeling a divine presence of healing and hope-giving. But there are those moments in our lives in which the truth is known deep in our guts. And what we know in our guts, we know with a certainty. We don't need external corroboration. We don't need someone to say, oh yeah, that's theologically accurate. We just know that it is. God dies when there is divorce. We just feel it as right. Let the theologians catch up with Justin, kind of thing. One of the pieces of discernment that we'll come back to is trying to make decisions from that place of truth. Trying to come to those places where we can feel in our deep guts what we know to be most life-giving, most right, most peaceful, most hope-giving. To try to make decisions, respond to life from that deep gut of knowing is what the practice of discernment is seeking to nurture. Does that make sense?
Yeah, a little bit, maybe.
All right, third reason why I tell that story is this is not easy. These decisions that confront us can be gut-wrenching. They can be agonizing. And it's not always clear which way is the right way to go. In fact, we find ourselves pulled in different directions. At different times, I felt like getting back together with Kim was the absolute right thing to do. And at other times, I felt like the divorce was the absolutely right thing to do in the midst of that pain. At different times, I felt both sides of those, right? And in feeling either of those attractions to one side or the other, those are not pure attractions either. My own impulses and motives to be drawn in that direction are mixed. That desire, that feeling like we really need to get back together. What is that about? In part, maybe that's about deep care that still exists between me and this woman. In part, maybe it's about my own fear of what it would be like to live alone and my own neurosis around that. Maybe it's my worry about Justin and what's going to happen to him and him being able to survive. And that would be a very honest kind of thing. Maybe it's my own fear of wanting to avoid the pain of my own parents' divorce and trying to avoid that completely and just put it out of my way by not going down that road myself. Which of those are God's impulses, and which of those impulses are from my own neuroses and my own pains and my own self-deceptions? Trying to weed those out and distinguish and discern that which has a divine impulse from that which has an impulse in my own self-deceptions or fears or wounds, that's what discernment, the practice, is trying to do. And it is dog hard. It can be gut-wrenching. Does that make sense? That's just one decision that faces us, right? I mean, hopefully it doesn't face all very many of us. But think of all the decisions that we face in our lives that are really agonizing. What are some of those that we struggle with?
Career moves.
Career moves. Do I stay in this job or do I get another job? Do I start a business? Do I get another degree and try another field completely? Gut-wrenching, agonizing, painful decisions.
Leave your career and stay home with your children.
Leave your career and stay home from your children. What is the best for all parties involved? Ah, gut-wrenching. What else?
Retirement.
Retirement. When to retire? What to do in your retirement? Yes, absolutely.
Pulling the plug.
Pulling the plug. Of, oh, yeah. Oh, gut-wrenching. Yeah. Yeah, when is it time? Yeah. How about dating? You know? Staying in this relationship or not staying in this relationship? Is this the one? Should we get married? Right. How about, what do I do when I graduate? Get another degree, stay in school, get a job, move to Holden. There's another context, right? Am I called to stay in Holden now that I've been here? Right? Or is it time for me to move on? Gut-wrenching, agonizing decisions, and we can feel ourselves pulled in different directions, in both directions, or in more than one direction, more than two directions. How do we distill those promptings of God that move us toward life, wholeness, peace, reconciliation from those impulses within us that are based more in fear and in prejudice and in woundedness and the like? That's the practice, right? Well, does anybody know anything about it? I'd sure like to know.
I thought you were going to tell us.
That's right. Well, that's the thing about discernment, is it not? How easy it would be if God just wrote letters in the sky, right? Surrender, Dorothy, you know? Just give me that sign, a burning bush, you know, something, right? Get a master's in theology. Don't get a master's in theology. Avoid it like the plague. Right? So if we just had a decision, if the Pope would tell us, or the priest, or a parent, and we had the answer in the direction, how easy it would be, right? But that is the challenge, but that's also the invitation. For discernment is about coming to stand on our own two feet and coming to recognize that God is inviting me, speaking to me, bringing impulses within me that are luring me and pulling me in the directions towards God's shalom. And I can develop the facilities to be able to discern that out in the midst of community. It's sort of growing up, right? So, how do you do it? Well, I don't know exactly, but I'm struggling in the way like all the rest of us. And but there is sort of the one person, certainly in my tradition, but in whenever people talk about discernment, there's one figure that looms out who has created a process that is just classic. And it is, of course, Ignatius of Loyola, the founder of the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits. And he himself has put together a way of trying to work with discerning these different impulses. And the more I struggle with it and play with it, the more I see it's just brilliant. It's just an incredible process. And I describe it briefly in the chapter, and I'll unfold it for a few minutes here. But before I do, Ignatius had sort of a Cliff Notes version. That didn't make the chapter either. The chapter would have been too short if we just went to the easy version, right? But his easy version was very simple. He said, when you find yourself in these kinds of agonizing decisions, ask yourself three questions, or any one of the three. First of all, he said, imagine that you are on your deathbed. Imagine your deathbed is just a short while from now. Maybe it's 2 years from now. And imagining yourself on your deathbed, looking back at where you are with the decision you're struggling with right now, what do you hope you decided? What do you wish that you, what direction do you wish you went down? That's a brilliant question. Because it puts it right in the context of the ultimate. And a second question. He said, imagine that you are in the presence of one of your most beloved loved ones. If you're a parent, perhaps it's your child. Maybe it's your parent. Maybe it's a spouse. And imagine somebody who you really yearn for their own flourishing. You really yearn for their happiness and their peace. And imagine they were struggling with this decision. What would you want them to do? What would you like for them to move into? Cut to the chase, right? And then a third question. He says, imagine that you are before the judgment seat of God, and you are in God's presence, and imagine that you can see God's own yearnings for you. God's own yearnings for faithfulness, God's yearnings for connectedness, for relationship, for the flourishing of life, God's yearnings for creation, and you find yourself face to face with that divine presence. Which decision do you feel is most true to the face-to-face relationship in which you are in right then? Which decision do you feel most sustains that? Are you most proud of? Do you most feel right about in light of God's own yearnings for you? Three questions to play with. So, make sense? All right, so that's the Cliff Notes version, right? But it's not always that easy either, right? We just still find ourselves agonizing about it. How are we doing? I mean, kind of getting on a roll here. Any thoughts? Or?
Yeah. You know, there's some assumptions that when you make a decision like that, that there's a right and wrong, too. And I think we come from a culture where we feel that it's either or. Mm-hmm. And I think that needs to be, I mean, you know, it's from a Western perspective and a Western thought, too. So I think that needs to be modified, too. It puts a lot of pressure on individuals, and I'm not sure that's always true.
Mm-hmm.
That you take one, it's good, or the other one is bad. And I think that needs to be considered and thought out, too.
Mm.
And that there needs to be a softness to all these decisions
Boy.
That we make, because, gosh, You know, I mean, I'm not sure that we our thought nowadays, modern thought, I mean, even in negotiation patterns and other kinds of these, we're talking about win-win, and we're not talking about win-lose. And yet we come from a culture of win-lose. Mm-hmm. So I think there's an assumption there. We need to modify a little bit that intensity of this.
I think that is absolutely right. And we all feel it. Like, which is the right decision and which is the wrong? If I go down this path, I am forever doomed. I missed my opportunity. I just, you know, from now on, fatally flawed because I'd made the wrong choice. And I do think that this practice and its theological context puts it in a completely different frame. Because, I mean, in the ultimate scheme of things, there is no wrong choice in terms of not being within the grace of God and God's own yearnings for us. I mean, we continue to be in that, certainly. And so we don't jeopardize that. I mean, that's works righteousness just in reverse, right? You know, we can step out by making the wrong decision or... be negligent in the decisions that we make.
But Western thought is very linear, and we need to be a little more circular.
That's right.
And a little helical, I think, or spiral, or however you want to look at it.
That's right. So how do we engage in the process that, and I also think, I mean, I was going to say this towards the end, but I don't think the practice of discernment is ultimately about making the right decision. I think it's ultimately about engaging in the right practice. It's engaging in the right process, the right kind of reflection, the right kind of attention, the right kind, you know, having our questions put in the right location. It's about that. And when we engage in that right process, if we make a decision that ultimately is not the one that is best for us or the one that is most going to bring about God's yearnings in the world, if we're still engaged in the right process, we're going to know that. You know, when we step in that direction, the music is going to sound discordant. And we're going to say, no, I need to step back and step in another direction that is more harmonious. It's about nurturing that process more, much more, than it is about finding the right decision. It's a way of life. It's not finding the answer. I think that's absolutely, absolutely true. So what is this process, then, that... that Ignatius describes? Well, I'm just going to kind of give several dimensions to it, and it's of course going to sound a lot more linear than it really is, because it's really much more like steps in a dance. I mean, these are different movements that we participate in, and they all interrelate with one another, and we find ourselves doing them in different times and in different ways, but the different kinds of ingredients that Ignatius says needs to be part of this process, I think, are very illuminating. So think of these not as the step down the path, but as steps in a dance that we are invited to kind of mingle with. And he's got a number of things that he invites us to do. First of all, he asks us to, sort of as a precondition, to try to commit ourselves to seeking and knowing God's yearnings for creation. To try to commit ourselves to seeking and to knowing what God yearns for in creation. And this brings up many issues, but one of them is, what is our understanding of who God is and what God yearns for in creation? Have you ever heard anybody talk about, I think God wants me to, become a missionary to some foreign land because it's the last thing in the world I want to do. I will avoid that like the plague, and it'd be just like God to say, that'd be good for you. Get over it. Right? What does it sound like?
Yeah, it's my mother.
It sounds like your mother. That's exactly right? And that's discernment. Let's distill out the voices that are really our mother inside of us, or our father, or our culture, or whomever, from the voices of God. But that means we need to reflect upon, who is God? Is that the kind of God that we worship, that we celebrate, that we know in the scriptures? Or is God someone who is on our side and yearns for our fullness and yearns for our peace? The kind of God that we are reflecting upon, the image of that, is going to drastically affect our process. And so to constantly try to say, I need to be on that journey of knowing God more fully and what God really yearns, and distilling that from my own parents or whatever tapes and voices are within me. And that means, of course, that the practice of discernment is intimately woven with everything else we do in the Christian community. It's intimately woven with worship and reading scriptures and dialoguing together and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, because that's where we come to know and learn about God. But there's another dimension to this too, and that is that Ignatius insists that our priority, we need to pray that our priority will be to try to find that direction to move in that is most harmonious with God's yearnings for us and for creation. That becomes the number one passion, motive behind our quest. And that means, he says, that we need to develop the attitude of indifference towards all other motives and attachments. Indifference, meaning that we need to become free from our motives towards, I want to get vengeance, right? Or I want to move in the direction that I'm going to become most famous. Or I want to move in the direction that is most lucrative. Or I want to move in the direction that maintains my sense of control or my security. Those are all idolatrous motives, according to Ignatius. And we need to develop an indifference to those kinds of attachments and seek rather as our primary hope and purpose to be harmonious with God's yearnings for us. Does that make sense? The play today was brilliant on that exact point, I thought. I was one of the plays that just immediately rose out. I mean, here was this person, and his motive was what? To be liked by everybody, right? To be a good person, to be able to advance in this law firm, so his name is on the plate, to be secure. Those are all of his motives, right? And as he tries to navigate his life, he's impassioned by those instead of what is God's yearnings and call for us as people? Developing indifference to the one and a passion to follow God's yearnings as our primary motive is the predisposition that Ignatius says we need to cultivate and develop in the midst of our practice. Does that make sense? Okay, and there are many, many attachments that we have, right? Okay, well, what else then he says? Well, Ignatius then says we need to engage our minds, right? That we are not, you know, God gave us minds and we are to use our common sense and the skills that are available to us. And those include all of the different kinds of things that we have, that we practice anyway, right? We make lists of pros and cons and try to see all the different things that the consequences of moving in one direction versus the consequences of moving in another direction. We try to elicit advice from loved ones and friends and experts on the field, right? We are struggling with the decision about divorce, to try to understand what are the effects of divorce on children and what are the resources that are available and things like midlife crisis and what are healthy relationships and etc. I mean, trying to become as informed about the different dimensions of your decision as you possibly can is just a normal thing that we need to engage in. And God speaks through our minds as much as God speaks through other means as well. So we do those kinds of normal practices that I think are second nature to all of us, right? So, okay, but then Ignatius says, that's just preliminary. And this is the place where the real pulse of discernment comes into play. And that is that Ignatius says God wants to speak to us through our heart. And it's our feelings that are the clues towards which God's voice is moving. Our feelings. And so Ignatius asks us to pick one of the different options. Particularly, we ought to pick the one that we are most negatively attracted to. The one that we think, gosh, that just does not feel right. That does not seem like the one to go to, right? Pick that one and live with it for a while. For several days, perhaps. If you have the time, longer than that. But live with it. And as you live with it, and this is the part I think that is just genius, be attentive to all of your feelings around it. All of the different feelings you get as you imagine yourself moving in that direction. What are the different things that happen? As I imagine myself moving to this house, well, what some of it kind of jazzes me. You know, what is that about? What are the different things that jazz me? The new space, you know, living in the mountains instead of in the city. You know, some of the things scare me, though. You know, is it really going to turn out? Is Justin going to find friends? Is, you know, all the different feelings that we have, and they are a mixed bag. But make a list. Keep track of the different emotions, the emotional attractions and the emotional repulsions that we have towards one particular possible direction, right? And then he says to take those into prayer and to try in prayer to discern whether or not those feelings are harmonious with the feelings and yearnings of God, or whether or not those feelings and emotions are discordant with that. And how do we do that? Well, Ignatius says, we first of all need to cultivate a prayer of centeredness and silence. And so we try to go to a place where we experience that stillness that beats at the heart of creation. Maybe we come to Holden for a few days, right? Because here's that stillness. The trappings of life, the busyness of life melt away for a while. Or maybe it's in an actual posture of prayer, and we breathe deeply, and we get into meditative positions. Maybe we retrieve in our imaginations those places and moments when we felt completely connected and in the presence of truth. Perhaps I will remember that conversation with Justin and that absolute bald-faced truth that was spoke there, that whatever I decide, they need to be held up to that litmus test of Justin's yearnings for himself to stop crying and God to stop crying and the yearnings for healing in our world. Wherever that is for us, to go to that place and to go there more than once, I mean, to go there repeatedly, but where we can let go of all the other things that preoccupy us and those attachments. And when we go there then, take those different feelings that we have about that direction that we're playing around with and let them echo down deeply inside of us so that we might try to see and feel what is that really all about. That gut-wrenching fear I have about seeing Justin mourning and crying to the point where I tell myself there is no way in this world I will ever put him through that pain. No way. What is that about? And to let that feeling, that anxiety, that angst, that shame, that guilt, and all of that wrestle down in me. And Ignatius says, let it echo down. Let it echo down deeply until you can uncover the roots of what that is about. And what is that about? Getting in touch with my own yearnings for Justin to have a safe world, peaceful world, is part of what that's about. But as I go in prayer, I also recognize that it's about something else too. It's about the way in which I was 12 years old and my parents told me that they were getting a divorce. And I told myself when I heard that I would never feel that kind of pain again in my entire life and closed that off. And now I'm having to face that wound and see, can that be healed? And part of my aversion to that is my fear of engaging that pain and that wound. But in prayer, allow that to open up. Whatever those feelings are, allow that to open up and sink down. And as it sinks down, Ignatius says, you will either discover feelings of consolation, feelings of resonance, like, yes, this is right. This is life. This is hope. This is power. You'll either experience those feelings, or you will experience feelings of desolation, feelings of this is just wrong, this is turmoil, this is confusion, this is conflict. And depending on which feelings surface, that's where the glimpse of God's impulse to lead us is found. For God is a God of peace and wholeness, and we can trust the feelings of consolation that we have. So try to distill those out and move in those directions.
Am I making any sense at all?
Okay, then Ignatius would say, do that for a spell, right? Do that for a week. Do that for a month if you have it. If you don't rush these decisions, if you can at all avoid it. But after a certain spell of time, do it for the opposite direction. Or maybe you've got more than two options. Maybe you've got three or four or whatever. Do it for a variety and do the exact same thing. Live in that and start to attend to what are the feelings that I start to get when I imagine myself going down that direction. And then take those feelings into prayer. And where you can discern the feelings of consolation, you've got a great clue that that's where God is pulling and luring us to move. Make sense? But it's not that easy. Because Ignatius says, the devil is a seductive beast. And the devil sometimes can come in disguise, which is to say that sometimes what we are certain are feelings of consolation, they are not really coming from that deep space. And so when I am tempted to have an affair in the midst of my 10-year marriage and I'm 40, and it feels so right, right? A feeling of consolation, life, and peace. That very well may be the devil tempting us in the form of feelings of consolation. We have to be wise as serpents. We have to be scrutinizing to really dig down deeply to try to get to those most full feelings of consolation. And the opposite is true too. Sometimes conflict is the path towards wholeness. Sometimes the messiness is where the community needs to be. Sometimes pain is the way to new life. And God is pulling us in those feelings as well. That's what makes discernment such a tricky thing. Be attentive, scrutinizing, and reflective, but mostly prayerful. Right? So how are we doing so far?
Yeah, sounds good.
You know, I'm hearing a lot of what I would call Eastern thought in what you're saying, the emphasis on meditation or contemplation, the non-attachment to ego-related results.
Uh-huh. I think there's a lot of commonalities between Eastern thought and practice through much of this. And it's to remind us that Eastern traditions of meditation and contemplation and are not the only traditions that have that. Our own tradition, Christian heritage, has a deep stream of this kind of practice. It's Catholics. I couldn't resist. Not just the Catholics, but some good stuff here, really.
Ignatius was a Buddhist, really, you know.
That's right.
You're describing this as a very individual process, but certainly the example you're giving this, I imagine this was not an individual decision.
Mm-hmm.
Can you comment on that?
Yeah, so I mean, and that would be the next, right down my outline, so. Right, I mean, so another part of this whole process is that we don't do it just by ourselves at all, but we do that in community, and we do that in dialogue with a variety of partners. One of the skills of the practice of discernment is to choose those partners well, and that can help us in that process. And they can be a variety of people. In Catholic spirituality, it is often spiritual directors. It can be therapists. It could be calling the community in which we are most fully attached to and calling them together. It can be our confidants and our friends. But it is certainly to engage engage in processing this with the people that can help us in that gut-wrenching decision-making process. The Quakers have a beautiful practice that gets at precisely this point on what they call a clearness committee. And that is when you are struggling with a decision like this, you would ask a group of people to come together and say, I need help in trying to discern which way God is calling me. I mean, where the light is found. I need help with that. But the caveat that that I want to offer is that we need to choose those people carefully and engage with them respectfully and reflectively, because people, we all have our own wounds and prejudices and blind spots, and they are going to be part of that process. So that, you know, the persons who come and say, never divorce, I mean, think about the kids, just don't do it. Maybe that's about a real insight into what God is yearning for what that particular family, or maybe that comes from their own fears or from their own wounds or from whatever. And we all have those, and we need to be very, very careful, because in the end, nobody's going to have the right answer for us. We have to discern. The interesting thing about the Clearness Committee is that the check against bringing the community bringing their own propensities for deception into that, the check is you don't give any advice. You only ask questions. That's all you do in the community. You only ask questions. And the questions that you ask are for the other person. You know, what does it feel like to you when you think about that? You know, what images come to mind when you think of that? Like, did you think God is somebody, you know, are there any similarities between the voice that you're saying that God is telling you and your parents' voice? I mean, the comment about that's my mother. Do you see any connections about that? And you just are opening up questions to help persons expose some of their assumptions about who God is, or to help illuminate some of the shadow dimensions, or to help attend to some of the different feelings that are more uncomfortable but are needing to be looked at as well. The community aids in that process. Doesn't mean self-deception is not in clearness committees, but there's a check for that, and there's a mindfulness about that. Yeah, absolutely.
What you've been talking about so far has been kind of related to a personal walk. I'm trying to relate this to decisions, for example, a congregation might make, which also can be very difficult. And it seems like with 200 or 1,000 or whatever members you've got, things can get a lot more complicated.
Yeah. Well, and Ignatius develop this into a process for communal discernment, and the Quakers too develop processes for communal discernment. What's interesting is that both of those processes are dependent upon the individual practices of prayer and cleansing and wanting to be attentive to what God is yearning for in this community, and trying to detach from my own investments and my role in this community, and how do I maintain my power, or how do I get my way and agenda pushed, to try to engage in that practice of becoming detached from those. Is indispensable to the Ignatian and the Quaker model for communal discernment decision making. But like you say, it's a very complicated and a very difficult process. There are some terrific guides for that. In fact, I got one. If you don't know this book by the Center for Conflict Resolution, Building United Judgment, a Handbook for Consensus Making, it's just a terrific resource. It's not in the reference section of the Practicing Our Faith book. But to try to help a group of people facilitate that process, and what kinds of practices help us reflect upon the agenda that we have, and what do we do when they just become conflictual, and how do we develop skills of really listening and detachment and all of those other kinds of things. Yeah, that's where it gets really rough.
I'm just happy to hear you say that discernment is a process and not the decision, because in my experience, when I had to discern things, both options seem just fine. And I feel like that is such a gift that I can do either one, and because I live in grace, if it wasn't the perfect decision or the right decision, I'll either know that quickly or I can make something out of it anyway. So it's like you really can't make a bad decision if you've discerned something well enough.
And I love that idea. That I mean, that we find ourselves in two goods situation. But I would like to say, you know, that even when we are in, you know, conflict kinds of decision, they both seem bad or whatever, that situation is also a gift. Because, I mean, Ignatius's process, seriously, because in the indecision, we are afforded a unique opportunity to explore our own walk with God, our own attachments, our own phobias and neuroses and deceptions that block that, and our own impulses for new life. It's an opportunity, it's an invitation to really explore that. As painful as it is, these are also gifts as well. And in that sense, there is no lose. If we engage in that process, it is going to be a continual process of growth, of deepening, of maturity. And the other thing I want to say about that is that we can also get mired in the process. Mm-hmm. At some point, we got to make a decision. And the decision is also part of the process. I mean, when we then decide, okay, this is where I am feeling called to go. This feels absolutely right. Or I'm still conflicted, but you know, I've got to make a decision. The deadlines are here, and I've got to do it. And I'm just going to move in a direction that feels most right at this moment. That is part of the process. And when we step in that direction, we don't stop now the process. In fact, we might intensify it. As we move in that, we begin to look even more at, how do I feel as I'm doing this? Does this really resonate? Do I have a sense of peace about this? Is this giving life, or is this not becoming anything like what I thought it was going to be? At which point I step back and say, I need to go in another direction, or I need to rethink and re-pray what is going on. The action step is part of the process, and it becomes a way of life, of continually reflecting upon how am I experiencing myself in harmony with God's yearnings for creation? And when am I experiencing myself out of connection with that? And that could become a daily thing, a daily thing. Justin wants ice cream. You know? No, yes, it's vacation, it's bad for you, what do I do? I mean, you know, what are God's yearnings? Give the kid ice cream.
I love the part in the book about the Quaker community discernment process. The idea that when things get heated and people are talking and sort of their own agendas or they all have very different views and it's an argument, everyone stops and is quiet until it's time, until they feel that it's time to speak again. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's amazing. And it can take days. I mean, as long as it takes, that's okay. They take as long as they need. Mm-hmm. And eventually it will come out. And I think that's amazing, that stillness, that stopping as a group, agreeing that that's the way to go, mm-hmm. and then beginning again.
Right, and that's very similar to Ignatius's prayer. I mean, you know, develop a contemplative posture and return there. When things get conflictual and the vertigo sets in, go back there. Yeah. And what you know, he would say for communal discernment is, I mean, it's the exact same thing. I mean, get together and pull all the information and pick, you know, the various options and then live with those for a while. Don't make the decision right now, but prayerfully engage one option. All of us individual, let's prayerfully reflect for the next week about how that feels. And when we get back together, let's pool that information. And when things get heated again in the midst of that, let's just take a deep breath and recenter and remind ourselves of why we are here and what our yearnings are ultimately and how can we make decisions out of that space.
I think we've all had a reflection of this room and even outside of Holden here about how God has made responsibilities for everybody and their decision making for everybody, but what about God and his decision for himself, and how does he make it for himself? Now, I think that would be really hard
to
do.
It's say? I'm not exactly sure.
Well, for the responsibilities of all the decision making that he has for everybody, and that everybody wants for his decisions to be made. Well, how does God make his own decision for himself?
Trinitarian mysteries. Yeah, I don't know. I'll leave that for the theologians. I wouldn't even know where to begin to go with that. But yeah, but it's an interesting question to reflect on. You know, what are insights about how does God make decisions, and God's yearnings and God's lurings? And, Well, let me add one last piece, if I'm not cutting anybody off on this, and that is the question, how do you know if you're right? We go through this process and we come up with that feeling or that decision, or as a community, we think this is the direction, and the question, how do we know if we are right? By what criteria do we use to adjudicate as individuals or as communities that yes, that is the direction that seems to be most life-giving and most harmonious with the Spirit? And think of all the times in history when people have claimed insights from God or voices from God that we can now look back, if we didn't then, and say they were riddled with self-deception, right? You know, did God tell John Hinckley to shoot John Lennon? You know? He would say yes. He did say yes. You know, how, by what process or by what standards do we as a community say, no, that is not true to the God we know? Right? What is it? Is it killing? Did God tell Dietrich Bonhoeffer to kill Hitler? Which one? How do we make the decision in one way or another? Right? Well, there have been a variety of things that have been suggested as litmus tests or criteria by which we might make those decisions or make some of those judgments. But the problem is, none of this is easy. None of these are absolute, right? None of them can become the actual thing that we can say that proves that that decision was right or wrong, because we can find exceptions to any one of them. And let me name some. We know some of these. I mean, one criteria: is it true to the biblical writings? Is it in harmony with the biblical witness, the Bible? And there's certainly a criteria that we would all, I would imagine, connect with, right? But that's not an absolute criteria, is it? Because people have claimed biblical authority and credibility for decisions that we can look at and say, absolutely not, in hindsight. You know, the Bible was used to justify slavery, for example, because the Bible does justify slavery in some places. That makes it we have to engage in a discernment process about that. But that's one of the pieces that we put into place about trying to dialogue with in terms of adjudicating whether or not we made a decision in harmony with God. Does that make sense? So some other criteria that would be suggested, though. Is it in harmony with the tradition of our church? You know, did Luther say it? Would be, I suspect. Maybe there's one absolute. I mean, I don't know. Or the Pope, you know, one or the other. But I mean, is it in line with the voices within the whole community of the church that have struggled and agonized with who is God and what does it mean to be faithful? But again, I mean, that's by far an absolute kind of criteria. We can find the tradition littered with suggestions and impulses that really suggest something different. So there are other criteria that we want to put into the mix as well. One of those is the fruit of the Spirit. Right? We can judge a fruit, we can judge a tree by the fruit that it brings forth. Does this decision, does this direction by a community or by an individual give rise to things like peace, joy, love, goodwill, compassion, justice? Does it give rise to those kinds of virtues, or is it in conflict with those kinds of things? You know, Teresa of Avila says, you know, the important thing is not to pray much, It is to love much. And that's the bottom line. Does it give rise to love? One other piece that we might bring to help us discern whether or not we are in the right direction. But again, that's open to self-deception and suspect to judgment. So other things. Is there a sense of peace? Inner certainty is another one of the suggestions that we might be on the right track. Does it feel right deep down in our guts, in our belly? Do we just know, you know, here I am, right? You know, self-authenticating, Luther knows he is on the right track. I think he was, right? No, I can see that. Does it give rise to communal harmony? Does this decision and the direction and the process by which we've made it help us to experience greater unity with one another and a sense of collectivity and the spirit binding us together as one people would be another one of those kinds of criteria that we might bring to the table. But again, by no means is that absolute. Churches and communities can be unanimous about things that are clearly self-deceptive. So that's not in and of itself a thing. So two other things that would be part of that is, does it enhance life or does it squelch life? Does this direction ultimately give rise to interpersonal health, relational wholeness? Does it move in the direction of life, or does it violate and squelch life and extinguish it? Would be another kind of criteria by which we might use to adjudicate whether or not we're on the right track. And the last one I would suggest is, are we being true to the process of discernment? Or are we avoiding pieces of the process? I'm willing to do everything you said tonight, but I am not about to pray my rage. There is no way. It's just too hard or too painful. I'm not going there, right? Or I'm willing to pray, and I'm willing, but I am not going to get together with my friends and have that because I know what they're going to say, right? Avoiding pieces of the process is another way of moving into very risky territory. One clue is the things that we most want to avoid are the things that we most need to bring to prayer, right? I know what those people are going to say, and there's no way I'm going to listen to that. That's the big clue that there's something there that we need to bring to prayer and reflect upon. Maybe because you are absolutely right, but you're just insecure about that. And you don't want to be knocked off your center, and that's why you don't want to go there. But you are right. Or maybe it's because they have a voice of truth that you don't want to hear. And we need to pray our antipathies to hearing what that voice of truth might be. So anyway, a list of things to help us. And of course, none of them are absolute. They are all things that we have to put into dialogue with one another, which is to say that this is not a science, right? It's more like an art. It's more like a dance that we practice different steps, and we hope that in the midst of moving in these different dimensions, notes of life will begin to ring forth, and that we will be able to recognize those notes of life as being the impulses by which God is pulling us into a world where God doesn't cry anymore. Yeah. So, well, I think we're past time. Thank you.